Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Court Case Podcast with me, your host, James Court.
And Sweet Tea.
We've got a very special episode today. We're going to be interviewing exonerated prisoner Jeffrey Deskovic.
Yes, a serious court case on the show today.
Jeffrey Deskovic was wrongfully imprisoned for 16 years for a crime he did not commit.
Well, we're going to be talking about the crime, the prison, the trial and where he is now. Hopefully everything is covered today.
The justice system may have failed him, but we're not going to today on the Court Case Podcast. All of that is coming right after this. Okay, hello everybody. We are live with Jeffrey Deskovic on the show today.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. How are you doing today? How's work been?
Work has been very good. It's kind of today is kind of it's a working day off.
Oh, that's great.
I'm mostly off today. It's Sunday, except that, you know, I'm doing this interview and, you know, I actually have another interview later on tonight. So I have that sandwiched around
nice.
A little bit of recreation. But earlier today, I played 4 games of chess. I went 3-1.
So oh, nice.
And now, you know, I'm visiting with I'm visiting with some of my friends, except when I'm doing the interviews.
Oh, nice. Cool. One. So how's life been for you during the pandemic? How's it been this past year?
Yeah, you know, it's really been difficult because a lot of things are shut down and, you know, and or hours are modified. How many times do you want to eat out? It becomes a little frustrating with everything is closed early.
Yeah,
you know, and quite frankly, it's something that's triggered me.
Yeah,
you know, in a lot of ways, it does remind me of prison. So look, I've heard people say, look, it's not like being in prison because you're still free. There's no guards. You're not in the cell. You have the internet. You have television, and however else you watch movies, if that's Amazon Prime, Netflix, or whatever.
Yeah.
The violence that's in prison is like, yeah, I get all that. That's all true enough.
Yeah.
That having been said, there are certain commonalities between being incarcerated and the pandemic, for example.
I can imagine.
You can't do many things, right? You can't travel. You can travel much more limited, whether literally is in a car, is in a plane, or even, you know, wherever you're going to walk to, drive to, ride a bike to. You know, your locations are greatly diminished.
Yeah.
So there's that, you know, it is quite isolating, which is another characteristic of prison.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing is that nobody knows how long this thing is going to end, is going to take before
that's true.
It ends. So that's also, but then maybe the last thing that jumps out at me is that everything, you're kind of living in your head and everything is some undefined point in time in the future that nobody actually knows when and if it's going to get there.
Yeah.
So you can think about things more than actually do things.
Yeah, of course.
Absolutely.
So it has kind of triggered me, you know, somewhat, you know, in that aspect. And, you know, it does get, you know, it does get difficult. You know,
yeah.
It does get a little bit depressing.
Yeah.
But, you know, so.
Especially for people living on their own. Are you living on your own?
Yeah, I am living on my own.
Mm.
So, yeah, I do have that challenge.
Yeah,
yes.
That can't be easy for you.
Mm. No, it's definitely not. You know, and at times I feel like zoomed out.
Yeah, of course. Like really lonely and everything. Yeah.
Yes. The other thing is, sometimes I try to make up for that.
Yeah.
And I've kind of gotten extreme in the other direction, and I kind of overschedule myself. I mean, five or six or seven things to do, so I'm not bored, I'm not depressed, but then you know, I can feel it's good to do like one or two important things and then have a series of lesser things of a lesser importance sandwiched around that.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to a format that you go from one important thing to another important thing to another.
Yeah,
to another,
yeah.
To another. I mean, it gets exhausting after a while a little bit.
Yeah. So, I want to get stuck in with your story and what's going on with you now. But I just wanted to ask first, you came to us to tell your story. How did you come across our show?
Yeah, so I'm on a listserv called Podcast Guests, and they list various podcasts. And I've also joined a number of podcast Facebook groups.
Mm.
And I've also ran searches within Instagram.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Mm.
So one of those three was how I came across.
I love that. Have you been on many?
I mean, I applied to a lot, and yeah. You know, I don't remember which of those three I came across. How I came across you specifically, but
yeah.
I do remember. You know, with the name and the beat appeared to be where this would be a fit. So
that's fair enough. Have you been on many podcasts before?
I've And I'm maybe 40 or 50. And
wow. Oh, damn. Okay. More than what we've done, to be honest.
It's kind of amazing how many podcasts are available, because I remember when podcasts were new and there was just a handful of them. And now, you know, there's hundreds, if not thousands of them. You know, and, you know, the vast majority of them do have decent sized audiences. So it's not like people are podcasting and just, you know, 5-10 people or less that are listening. I mean, people are building audiences. And what I really love about podcasts, as well as, you know, blog talk radio and even writing blogs, is that everybody's platform for the exercise of their freedom of speech is much, much larger now. It's not limited to traditional media, so you can get your message out there. And I think that that's, And I think that that's really good. Free exchange of ideas and information and learning and awareness. I think it's all wonderful.
No, absolutely. Podcasts have really taken off, aren't they? Especially the past year in lockdown.
I think really the podcast Serial really opened it up for everybody. That kind of really was the spear for the craze around podcasting, you know, in terms of listenership. And then, you know, people saw that there was a space to do it, so it's really great,
and it leads to wonderful opportunities like this one.
I probably would have never heard of you probably wouldn't have heard of me as well, so it's great in that way as well.
I can't wait to get learning about your whole situation.
So
let's dive in whenever you're all ready.
All right, here we go, let's get to the meat of it. So our listeners, we in previous episodes we've briefed our listeners briefly on your story, but could you tell us the main rundown?
Yeah, sure. I'll summarize it really nice and tight, and then anything you want me to elaborate on, I'll rely on you for your follow up questions.
Perfect.
So, I spent 16 years in prison.
Okay.
I got arrested when I was 16. I spent from age 17 to 32 in prison.
Wow.
For murder and rape I did not commit.
Mm-hmm.
I was wrongfully convicted despite a pretrial negative DNA test result. And ultimately, my wrongful conviction was caused by a coerced false confession, prosecutorial misconduct, fraud by the medical examiner, terrible public defender. You know, I lost seven appeals. I got turned down for parole because I maintained my innocence rather than expressing remorse and taking responsibility. And ultimately, I was exonerated after a total of 16 years in prison through further DNA testing. So the DNA data bank had been created, and that allowed me to go from saying that the DNA didn't match me to also being able to say who it actually did match. And so ultimately all of my charges were dismissed on actual innocence grounds. After 5 years, I received some financial compensation. I used some of that to start the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation for Justice, whose purpose is to free other people who are wrongfully imprisoned like I was, and then pursue policy changes aimed at preventing that from happening to others. So thus far, we've been able to free 10 people. We've been able to pass 7 laws. I have a master's degree. My master's thesis is on wrongful conviction causes and reform.
Wow.
And lastly, I got tired of sitting in the front row of the courtroom. I wanted to sit at the defense table, represent some of the clients, make some of the arguments. So as we sit here and speak right now, I am an attorney.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
That is such a fantastic
congratulations.
Turnaround.
Yeah.
Thank you. So that's it all in a nutshell. So it's all advocacy all day, all the time. You know, mainly on innocence, but I also have a strong secondary interest in other justice reform issues.
Yeah.
Which I don't spearhead, but I do jump in at strategic times and ways and use my voice and, you know, attraction for the media and all of that to further those issues in collaboration with the organizations that are spearheading those issues.
Wow.
Okay. Well, that's you
amazing
know.
That you've come out and you wanted to help other people. Like, yeah. You've done something with it.
Right. I feel very fortunate that, first of all, that I even made it out.
Yeah.
One of the lucky ones. I mean, my case is not rare. Per the National Register of Exonerations, has been 2,775 people have been exonerated. But those are us who have made it out. That's not the people that are still wrongfully imprisoned. Mm-hmm. So I do feel fortunate in that way. And then I also feel that I've had educational opportunities that other people haven't had necessarily. And so I do feel a strong moral obligation to do what I can. You know, hence doing this advocacy work. And I make sense of everything that happened to me in a kaleidoscopic type of way. I believe my purpose is to fight wrongful conviction for general justice reform in the world. And that's how I make sense of what happens to me. And I take that energy that I feel and I channel it into the work.
Yeah.
And you know, that's my valve, that's my release. That's how I'm not angry and feel like I'm making a difference.
That's
and
great.
Yeah, that is amazing. And you definitely are making a difference. Like, you've got 10 other people out. Like, that's amazing.
That's so good. I wanted to talk about the crime first, yeah, and sort of doing sections. So you were convicted because you gave a false confession. Is that, are false confessions common? Does this happen a lot?
Yes, it does. Coerced false confessions have caused wrongful convictions in 25%.
Wow.
DNA proven wrongful convictions.
Okay.
And while adults have given coerced false confessions, particularly vulnerable populations are youth and people with mental health issues.
And do you remember when you gave that false confession? Do you know sort of like why you thought to do that? What was going through your head?
Yeah, sure. I can tell you what was going through my head, but I think the better answer it would be if I can explain the circumstances around it, if I could put a little context.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Sure. Okay. So background-wise, let me just share that before I was a teenager, I wanted to be a cop when I grew up.
Okay.
So I got on the police radar because the police interviewed many students from the high school and some of them told the police they might want to talk to me.
Okay.
So that was how I got on their radar. Secondly, the victim was a classmate in two of my classes as a freshman, one as a sophomore. I knew her name. She knew mine. That was it. We weren't even on a high buy basis.
Okay.
I was a sensitive teenager and the police thought that my being emotional in response to the death of somebody that I barely knew, they thought that was disproportionate and therefore suspicious.
Right, I see.
Oh, okay.
Thirdly, they got a psychological profile from the NYPD, which purported to have the psychological characteristics of the actual perpetrator, and I had the misfortune of matching that.
Okay.
So I had about 6 weeks of interactions with the police in which the interactions took on the following dynamic, that half the time they would speak to me as if I was a suspect, and the other half the time they would pretend like they needed my help to solve the crime.
Okay.
That's from my wanting to be a cop when I grew up, before my teenage years, thinking about that as a career when I grew up. That's where that intersected.
Yeah.
Right,
just like I came from a single parent household, my father was never involved in my life in any way. I never met him until like much later in life after I was exonerated. So that intersected with the good cop, bad cop technique in which half, you know, one officer took a more aggressive role. The other one pretended like he was a friend. He was opposed to what's going on, but somehow powerless to intervene.
Mm.
So eventually they got me to agree to take a lie detector test by telling me that there was some new information that had come into the police file and they wanted to share that with me. And that would allow me to be more helpful to them.
Okay.
And they could also get past the part of the conversation where they would talk to me as a suspect. We could really focus in on finding the actual perpetrator.
Yeah.
So under those false pretenses, they got me to agree to take the polygraph, otherwise known as a lie detector.
Yeah.
So the next day, rather than go to school, I went to the police station for that test. Because it was a school day, my mother and grandmother, with whom I lived, thought I was in school, so they didn't call around looking for me. They drove me from Peekskill, which is in Westchester County, so suburban, middle class, ethnically diverse. They drove me out of county 40 minutes away to the town of Brewster in Putnam County.
Okay.
So that meant I wasn't able to leave anymore on my own. I was dependent upon the police.
Right.
I didn't have an attorney present. They didn't give me anything to eat. They gave me a four-page brochure, which explained how the polygraph worked, but then it had a lot of big words in it, which I didn't understand. But then I pushed past my own confusion by just thinking, well, I'm here to help the police, so what does it matter?
Yeah.
Let's just get on with it.
Mm. Oh, my gosh.
So from there, they put me in a small room and gave me countless cups of coffee to get me nervous. And then he attached me into the machine. And by the way, this polygraphist was a Putnam County Sheriff's investigator. Daniel Stevens was his name. And he was dressed like a civilian. He never identified himself as a cop. He never read me my rights. He was pretending to be a civilian.
Oh.
That is terrifying.
Mm.
And he attached the machine to me, and then he launched into his third degree tactic. So he invaded my personal space. He raised his voice at me. He kept asking me the same questions over and over again. And he kept that up for 6.5 to 7 hours.
Wow.
Towards the end of the interrogation, he said to me, "What do you mean you didn't do it? You just told me through the test results that you did. We just want you to verbally confirm it." And when he said that, yeah, that really shot my fear through the roof.
I can imagine.
I can't imagine what I would do if I was told that.
And then imagine the good cop comes in the room and tells me, "Look, these other cops are going to harm you. I've been holding them off. I can't do that anymore. You have to help yourself. Listen, just tell them what they want to hear, and they'll stop what they're doing. You could go home afterwards." So being young, naive, frightened, you're not going to be arrested. So being young, naive, frightened, 16 years old, overwhelmed emotionally and psychologically, I was not thinking about the long term.
Of course,
I was concerned was my safety in the moment. I was in fear of my life.
Yeah.
Because the fact that I did not know where I was and that nobody else knew where I was either loomed very large in my mind. And then it was this, you know, on the one hand, this false promise he gave me, and then there's this threat. So I decided to make up a story based on the information that they gave me that day and in the 6 weeks run up to it. And so by the time everything was said and done, I collapsed onto the floor into a fetal position and crying uncontrollably.
Jesus.
You know, oh my God.
Obviously I was arrested.
Yeah.
Bless you. That's awful.
I can't.
Then before the trial, the DNA test came in from the FBI lab, which showed that semen found in the victim didn't match me.
Mm.
But rather than acknowledge they made a mistake, they continued to prosecute full speed ahead.
Yeah.
So in order to counter that, the prosecutor got the medical examiner to commit perjury and commit fraud. Mm. So he suddenly came up with, this is right after the DNA didn't match me, he suddenly said, "Look, I remember that I forgot to document medical evidence that showed that the victim had been sleeping around," which is what opened the door for the prosecutor to argue that she might have slept with someone else before Deskovic murdered and raped her. That's why his DNA is not there. It's not that he's innocent at all. And then he took it a step further and named another youth by name that he claimed had slept with the victim.
Right.
But he never had a DNA test performed to prove that. He didn't even call this other youth as a witness. At the same time, the victim's family was not coming to court. So they had no idea that her reputation was being trashed in this way in order to wrongfully convict me. At the same time, my public defender essentially didn't defend me.
Oh.
He never called my alibi as a witness. I was actually playing wiffle ball when the crime happened. He didn't try to discredit this medical examiner at all. He literally asked him no questions at all. He should have never represented me because of a conflict of interest. So this other youth that the prosecutor was falsely saying had slept with the victim was represented by another member of that public defender's office.
Right.
And specifically by the lawyer supposed to be supervising him in my case. So that conflict prevented the defense from asking him to give a DNA sample. It prevented the defense from calling him as a witness to explode this consensual sex.
Bloody hell.
My interrogation was not videotaped. It was not audio taped. There was no signed confession. There was just the cop's word for it. And when they came to court, they left the threat and false promise out of their story.
Mm.
And my lawyer would not allow me to testify and tell what happened in the interrogation room.
Right.
Furthermore, when it came to the confession, sometimes he argued that the confession never happened. At other times, he argued that it happened, but it was false. And at still other times, he argued that it happened and it was coerced. So by taking this scattershot approach, I mean, the jury must have looked at him as somebody who just simply wasn't believable. The argument, like he was willing to say anything. He was taking all these inconsistent positions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then also a few other things, just for context, not to get into the weeds too much.
Yeah.
But it's illegal for polygraph evidence to be allowed into court unless both sides agree, because it's not reliable even when it's done under the best of conditions, which this was not.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah.
Mm.
But the judge came up with this backdoor rule. He said that because the confession happened while I was being polygraphed, he allowed this polygraphist to repeatedly tell the jury that I failed the polygraph test while blocking my lawyer from asking him any questions about how he formed his opinion.
Yeah.
And the last thing was that the victim's clothes were admitted into evidence. That included the bra. And that intersected with the false confession, because in one of the statements that they coerced out of me, I said that I ripped her bra off. So there's some bras that you cannot rip off of a body.
Right.
So the jury asked to see the bra. And when that happened, the judge then told everybody that the evidence, including the bra, had been left in the courtroom over the weekend, and that the janitors apparently thought that it was garbage, and they threw it out.
No way.
Yes, they threw it out.
This whole case sounds like a train wreck.
It does.
It really was. You know, I was completely in over my head. I had never been arrested for anything.
Yeah.
I barely understood fully what was going on, and my lawyer would not allow me to have my mother or any other adult be involved in the conversations between us when discussing strategy and discussing the case. And so that really left me at a really big disadvantage.
Yeah.
And so the end result of just point out, there's an 80% conviction rate when there's a confession.
Okay.
So if you're defending somebody that has confessed, you have to answer that confession. You have to explain that confession. You have to disprove that confession in as many ways as you can. and you bring it all together in your closing argument.
Yeah.
But my lawyer didn't do any of that.
Right.
So the end result of it all was that I was wrongfully convicted.
My God.
I've been charged as an adult. I was therefore sentenced as an adult. At the sentencing hearing, I begged the judge to overturn the verdict because I was innocent, and I referenced the DNA to support my contention. And he actually told me on the record, get a load of this. He said, maybe you are innocent.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So you would think if a judge says that, then there's doubt in the case. So the next logical thing that's supposed to flow from that is he's supposed to find a way to overturn the conviction. You don't just send somebody to prison. Maybe they're innocent. But instead, he didn't overturn the conviction at all, which he could have done by reversing any of the rulings he made against me in the course of the trial. He instead gave me a 15-to-life sentence,
Christ.
I was sent to a maximum security prison to serve.
And how did your family take the conviction? Did they believe you, or
they believed me? With the exception, I had one uncle that worked in law enforcement in a nearby city in the same county.
Right.
So the cops managed to convince him that I was guilty.
No way.
Yeah, right. And his daughter thought I was guilty, but beyond that. Everybody else believed in me, but the curious thing is that their belief in me did not translate into them trying to help me. They didn't stay in touch with me. They didn't help me keep going morale-wise. There were several times when my mother made rounds to everybody and was trying to get everybody to put in a manageable amount of money that everybody could do so that I could hire a lawyer.
Yeah.
To become exonerated, and everybody declined to do that.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, I'm so sorry that's happened to you.
So essentially, I did the 16 years, by myself.
Yeah. And
but
I would ask if all of these errors during the case, the men and women that were involved in it, did they face any punishment at all?
No, they did not.
Since you've been exonerated?
No.
Wow.
No, it did not. I would like to walk you through the appeals and how I was exonerated, and then I'll put a little bit more color to that last question.
Absolutely.
That would be great.
Okay. So I went to the appellate division. I had a different lawyer, different office. This lawyer did a great job. She raised 10 issues of law. All the issues that I mentioned to you, she raised all of them, and she did argue rather strenuously that I was innocent.
Good.
She argued that the verdict was against the weight of the evidence, the prosecution hadn't proven guilt beyond reasonable doubt, that there was legally insufficient evidence of guilt, that all my rights were violated, everything I mentioned to you. I'll leave it at that. In all told, she argued 10 issues. And first of all, the prosecution's answer to the DNA evidence, they made the argument that a negative DNA test result is no insulation to a guilty verdict.
Okay.
Which is kind of, crazy because the only evidence they have is this confession obtained under questionable circumstances, and DNA is referred to as the gold standard of evidence.
Yeah, of course.
So the court ruled that I was not in custody, that I was free to come and go as I wanted. So they ruled that the statements were voluntary.
Mm-hmm.
They wrote that there was overwhelming evidence of guilt. And then they got rid of the rest of my issues in one sentence by saying they looked at the rest of my issues and either found them to be without merit or not preserved for review. And they then ruled against me 5-0.
Wow.
And it all went downhill from there.
Yeah.
The argument motion was denied in one word. Then the New York Court of Appeals are high estate. So the procedure is you have to ask them for permission to appeal to them. And then only if they give you permission, then you can present your issues.
Okay.
So they declined to give me permission to appeal to them. Then I filed in federal court, but because my attorney was given the wrong information on the filing procedure by the court clerk, my paperwork arrived 4 days too late.
Right.
So the district attorney asked the court to just rule that I was late and dismiss my case instead of getting to the issues.
Christ.
And that's what the court did.
Okay.
And then I challenged that ruling in front of three more times. I went to the Federal Court of Appeals. Judge Sotomayor was one of the judges who would become a U.S. Supreme Court justice later. And she signed off on that decision. Then we moved to re-argue the motion in front of them, and that was denied. Then I went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they declined to give me permission to appeal to them.
Okay.
So that was the end of my appeals. Jesus. And in one of them, I was asking for additional DNA testing.
Yeah.
And before that, I had written in a letter, I had asked the district attorney to allow me to have further testing, and she didn't. And then I put it in the federal court. So that's the end of the appeals, right? So that means I'm permanently locked out of the courthouse.
Jesus.
This is 11 years in now. There's only two ways back in when that happens.
Okay.
If there's a change in the law.
Right.
And the second thing would be if you can find some new evidence, which would probably have resulted in a different verdict.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
So I wrote, I didn't have any money to hire an investigator or an attorney. So I wrote letters for 4 years looking for someone to take my case for free, hoping that they could find some new evidence to try to get back in court with.
Mm-hmm.
And rarely got responses back other than the occasional no.
Right.
And then I went to the parole board where, in part because instead of expressing remorse and taking responsibility, I maintained my innocence. Because of that, a big reason because of that, and then they cite nature of the crime, they declined to parole me.
Right.
And they told me to do another 2 years and come back and see us. And then I did another year, and then I was exonerated.
Okay.
So three things happened. So firstly, the Innocence Project agreed to represent me. The way that I got their help was kind of a random way. So one of the letters that I wrote to, and I wrote a letter to a book author in care of the publishing company. But somebody in the publishing company sent the letter to an investigator, Claudia Whitman, instead. Mm-hmm. And when she saw the DNA, she never heard of a case where some of the DNA didn't match somebody, but there was still a conviction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So she knew that I was innocent right away. As soon as I proved the test results to her,
of course. She
knew I was innocent. So she told me to write the Innocence Project. She lobbied them. She got other respected legal entities to also lobby them.
Good.
And then there was a caseworker, Maggie, her name was Maggie Taylor. And when the Innocence Project didn't want to take the case because of I was already excluded by the DNA. I mean, the way they were freeing people was they were just getting DNA test results and then introducing it into the court as newly discovered evidence.
Right.
They couldn't do that in my case because the DNA already didn't match me from before.
Yeah.
So they didn't want to take the case. So Maggie presented it a second time. She came up with a different theory, how the DNA could be used and not, and still be something new. And they shut that down. And then she presented it a third time. And this time her idea, which was something that I had suggested to her, the DNA data bank. This time, they agreed to take it, the case based on that. So that was the first thing. Second thing was former Westchester District Attorney Jeanine Pirro, who does a lot of commentary on television. She left office.
Okay.
And she was the one who fought all my appeals and blocked the testing. And the third thing was that we got lucky that when we put the crime scene DNA evidence into the database, it matched the actual perpetrator whose DNA was only in the data bank because left free while I was doing time for his crime. He killed a second victim just 3.5 years later. It was a school teacher and had two children.
Oh, no.
Jesus.
So on September 22nd, 2006, the conviction was overturned and I was released. And I reported back to court November 2nd, 2006, at which point all the charges against me were dismissed on actual innocence grounds.
Bit too late.
Yeah, very
bloody good.
Very too late, but
yeah. But what was the first thing that you did as soon as you were exonerated and left prison?
Well, there was a I left. Well, I was released from court, so they brought me from the prison to the court, and then the court overturned the conviction. So I left from the courtroom rather than from the prison. But first thing I did was there was a press conference, which I was not prepared for. And when it was my turn to speak, my first words were, "Is this really happening?"
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah, of course.
And from there, everything I ever wanted to say in 16 years, but could never get anybody to hear me, it all came out. So just when I thought I was finishing up,
yeah,
a different topic occurred to me. So that went on for like two and a half hours.
Mm.
And from there, there was a big luncheon. My first meal was I had mussels with Fran Diavolo sauce, a little bit of ziti on the side.
Wow.
Had a Neapolitan ice cream. Oof. And that was my first meal.
Oh, so nice. Good choice.
Yeah.
I'd love to tell you that right after that, we had this tremendous party that lasted to the next day. I'd love to tell you that. But that would not be true.
Yeah.
By that point, you know, I mean, I went to my aunt's house, and by that point, I had long since lost touch with everybody.
Of course,
a big skill. Everybody believed that I was guilty. Everybody hated me. You know, that was facilitated by the coerced false confession. You know, and like I said, the overwhelming majority of my extended family did not come to see me. And even the people that did, you know, like by the last 6 years, my mother came to see me like once every 6 months. So in many ways, I did the time by myself. And so, you know, I lost track of everybody. I remember just sitting at the table and everybody was drinking coffee and talking a little bit about what happened. And, you know, a couple of other people came over. But I felt out of place. I couldn't relate to any of the people. Mm. So I remember I just got up and just went outside to just sit outside during the, you know, in the dark, which is something you can't do in the prison.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's dark. They close the yard. So so that was really, I mean, so between just sitting outside and then, you know, I took a bath for the first time in 16 years. So that was the extent of any celebratory things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's the little things that you've missed out on that you need to.
That we take for granted. Like you don't.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. No, I do. I appreciate the feeling of the sun on my face, fresh air. Freedom of movement, you know, the opportunities that it exist education-wise, if you're willing to, you know, work hard. I mean, I do believe to a large extent you can be what you want to be.
Yeah. Do you find yourself feeling bitter, or do you feel angry that the people didn't face any repercussions and that you were put away for so long?
No, because I want to enjoy my life as much as I can. I can't do that if I'm angry or bitter. Mm. Another line of reasoning also is that I feel like I've lost so much. Why would I want to, in effect, give them the rest of my life?
Yeah,
of course.
That's very true.
Mm.
And it's not like I'd be affecting them if I was angry or bitter. I mean, I would really be the only loser in that situation.
Yeah.
And as I mentioned, the vehicle that allows me to actualize that is I take the energy that I feel and I channel it into the advocacy work that I do.
That is such a positive way of thinking about it.
Absolutely. You know, I hadn't thought about that when I was thinking about interviewing you. Mm. That was one of the bigger questions I wanted to ask you, and I did wonder.
Yeah.
And I think that's such a good answer.
Yeah, that is
to that. And
how are you with your family now? Are you still close? Are you closer with them, or?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm close to them, but you know, when I first started out, you know, it was awkward when I would meet up with them because I knew who they were. Intellectually from memories of interacting with them when I was younger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, but I was a different person now and so were they. And when you spend long amounts of time away from people, just the evolution and personalities and character and everything, you become like a different person. So it was awkward at first, but I think I'm in a good place now, you know, that I do enjoy some family interaction. I mean, it would probably be a stretch to say I'm close with them, but I do spend some time with them. I do get some some interaction with him.
Yeah.
That's good. I do want to get on to your current work, but I did have some burning questions about prison first that I wanted to ask.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's do the prison. Yeah.
Yeah. do you have any... Do you have any distinct memories of prison that you would like to share, like some main ones?
Yes, I do. So it was very violent there. There were three or four stabbings or cuttings every day in Elmira Correctional Facility where I was. There was a lot of gang activity, so you always had to be on alert. Your adrenaline was always running. You know, I had a bullseye on my back because I was there for a rape with a murder.
Yeah.
I mean, how those people convicted of sex offenses.
Yeah.
The food was terrible. Sometimes it was burned. Other times it wasn't fully cooked. Mm-hmm. They had a system of maintaining order in the prison
mm-hmm.
where if a prisoner was found guilty of having broken a prison rule that they would be kept in the cell 23 hours a day. They would send you less food. Sometimes the food would be 3 or 4 days old. You would you'd only get 1 hour a day recreation in a small caged area with maybe a pull-up iron if you were lucky.
Wow.
You could not go to the store while you were on that status or use the phone. So there were times in the course of my incarceration where I was beat up. Sometimes one time I nearly lost my life. I'll get into that in a minute. Mm. But the impact of that was that I was subjected to those sanctions because I tried my best to defend myself. I mean, that meant the prison considered that I was fighting.
Yeah. Right.
Though that was what, I mean, and I had to frequently fight off feelings of hopelessness, helplessness, you know, thoughts of giving up, suicidal ideation.
Yeah.
So I had to fight those things off. Sometimes people ask me how I got through it. Belief in God was one thing. Another thing was I used to go to the law library and learn the law because I didn't trust the lawyers to defend me anymore.
Yeah, of course.
I used to collect articles about other people who were exonerated and what, you know, study, you know, what route did they take, who helped them. So I took advantage of the limited educational programs they had. I got GED, I got the associates, I got a year towards the bachelor's before funding was cut. And I did other vocational trades. And from 1998 to 2006, I read 3 or 4 nonfiction books each week. And I learned how to play chess. I engaged in this elaborate delusion when I was playing chess or basketball or ping pong. I pretend like I'm a professional player. And
so
it
was
But it wasn't like kids playing on the playground. I mean, it was like a defense mechanism. I needed to leave the prison for a few hours. And I used to cut pictures out of nature scenes, and you could hang, there was a small part of the prison wall where you were allowed to hang pages up of nature scenes. So I used to do that.
That's
but nice. In terms of a couple of other vivid things. So firstly, towards the end of my sentence minimum, the prison authorities told me that if I wanted to have any chance at all of making parole, that I would have to take and complete the sex offender training program.
Right.
But the problem is that they ran it kind of similar to AA, so where you have to admit you have a problem in order for any
oh my god.
I see.
So, they wanted me to admit guilt. They did everything in their power to try to force me into that class, but I wasn't willing to go because I would have been required to admit guilt to the instructor and to the other prisoners, and they wanted all the details. Like, I couldn't just say, yeah, I did it. They wanted like a blow-by-blow account of everything. In writing, not even verbally. They wanted it all in writing. And so, I refused to do that. So that was just vivid memory. They did everything they could to force me into that. I mean, they refused to transfer me closer to home. They refused to transfer me from a maximum security prison to a medium. They had a family reunion program where your family could come up, say, on a Friday and stay with you on a trailer located on the prison grounds from Friday until Sunday. And they refused to allow me to participate in that with a family member unless I took that program. So all those things they tried to.
So mean.
Yeah.
Yeah. they had an honor block where they had a few creature comforts. You know, had like a stove and a refrigerator, and you could go to recreation more, and you could go to a store once a week rather than. So, you know, they wouldn't allow me to be on the waiting list for that until I took the program. So they did everything under the sun.
Yeah.
Good, but I didn't break because all those things paled compared to the larger point.
Yeah.
So that was one vivid memory, and I think that the worst time of it all, I remember. So I was in solitary confinement. So I got sent there once in 60 years. So I was in solitary confinement because there were four prisoners that were coming to stab me because, as far as they were concerned, I was a rapist.
Yeah,
you know,
Jesus.
And I didn't wait for them to do that. I took the battle to them.
Yeah.
And I did the best that I could, but oh. I'm not a fighter. I'm not a criminal either.
Yeah, yeah.
So I got the worst end of it. You know, I got hit multiple times on the side of my head with a 10-pound weight plate. Oh. So I almost got killed. They sent me into the solitary confinement where they take the majority of your property. The lights are on all the time. You can't see this. You can't see the sky. There's no clock. The only way you know, have an idea of what time of the day it is because if they serve breakfast food on the tray, if you're not awake when they come around to feed you, they don't feed you. Like that happened to me. I woke up and they were feeding the prisoner in the cell next to me, and they refused to feed me. They told me be awake on time next time.
Oh, Jesus. My God.
I was there in that situation, and you try things, you know, they let you have a couple of books, but, you know, after 2 or 3 days, it's over with. You know, you read already. They bring it around once a week. And then, you know, you try to sleep some of the time away, but after a while, I mean, how many 14-hour days can you do sleeping? And
yeah.
You can't sleep anymore. And then it's just you and the cell wall and the ceiling. And so while I was wrongfully imprisoned, right, nearly killed, I'm there because I'm defending myself against people who think I'm a rapist because I've been wrongfully convicted. And while I'm there, in the middle of all that, that's when I got word from the federal court that I lost because the court clerk gave my lawyer the wrong information and my paperwork arrived 4 days too late.
Fuck.
That was the lowest point.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if I'm strong enough to be able to deal with
that. No, yeah.
Like, I don't know how you've done
it. Hit after hit after hit. Yeah. It's just...
So that was the hardest point. The other thing I'll say is, in terms of on a prolonged basis, the last year in prison I did was the toughest because, you know, my appeals basically got me through the first 11 years. You just think, well, I just have to hold on just for a year or two for the next appeal, which I'm sure I'm going to win because I'm innocent and the facts and the law support me.
Yeah.
So that 4 years of letters not getting responses and getting denied parole also, that being shut. So at that point, I thought that I was going to die in prison for a crime I didn't commit.
Jesus. Yeah.
But it was at that moment, you know, that I had placed an ad in a local newspaper. Well, a paper called the Sacramento Bee, which was actually in California. So it really wasn't local at all. It was 3,000 miles away. And by the way, I came to place the ad in that newspaper because I had placed the ad in a more New York-based newspaper. And some sergeant who worked as a sergeant, a correction officer, in another prison, not even the one where I was at, he saw the ad and he wrote me up for placing the ad.
No,
because in the ad, I mentioned that I'm innocent. And, you know, Jesus. I need somebody to try to, I'm not just looking for a pen pal. I'm also looking for somebody who can help connect me to the necessary legal help I need. So maybe there's somebody, you know, that you could ask to look at my case, or maybe you could do some fundraising activity so I could hire. So the sergeant in another prison wrote me up, right, for soliciting.
Oh.
Ugh.
So, you know, then like a week after that, you know, I placed the ad in a different place, and I got in trouble for that too. And I went down to see this hearing officer, and he said, what's the deal here, Deskovic? Are you back again? The same thing? And I said, look, I'm not trying to break the rules. I'm not trying to, you know, be a problem. I'm innocent, okay? I'm here wrongfully.
Yeah.
My appeals are over. I don't have a lawyer. okay? I can be a good prisoner and place no ads at all and just stay in prison the rest of my life. Or I could write a letter trying to get somebody to help me.
Yeah.
I'm going to write letters to try to help me. So whatever you guys going to do, you do. I'm going to keep doing what I do.
Yeah, you
did. I got to try to get out of here before I die in here.
You didn't give up, and that's great.
So hence putting an ad in a paper 3,000 miles away.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and the person who answered that letter, his name was Scott, and he became like a pen pal. And he had been a crime victim, and he didn't feel like the system really treated him fairly. So he believed that I was innocent. So he saw himself and me as fellow crime victims, just in different ways.
Yeah. Right.
And he arrived kind of in the nick of time, just by letter, because I was openly asking him in letters, look, should I just quit? You know, this is never going to work. Maybe I should just go ahead and kill myself and be done with it all. You know, get out of here that way, you know. So that was another, but that last year, I mean, that was all context to me trying to explain how that last year in prison, was the most difficult.
Just battle after battle, constantly.
Yeah, it was.
Jesus.
When you were.
But I just did not give up, though.
No, you didn't. And that's amazing.
No matter all that, I refused to give up. I just did not give up.
That's great.
I kept going.
It's so admirable.
Many other people would have quit a long time ago.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, I would have done.
Yeah,
100%. Like, especially when it just seems it seemed that they had an answer for everything, and they had
the
way to get you.
And it was all the wrong answers as well. Yeah. Like, there was no evidence to back it up.
But
that's. I was going to ask though. Like, in prison, did you have anyone that you can confide in, or was your roommate? Was he nice? Like, what was it like?
Sure. So. There was another prisoner named Frank Sterling.
Mm.
And Frank and I kept each other going for 13 and a half years. So Frank had a similar case.
Right.
And, you know, it was another false confession case.
Oh, my gosh.
I believed in Frank's innocence because, first of all, the confession they got out of him, they hypnotized him first. I kid you not. So they hypnotized and got a confession out of him, and that was the case against him.
Wow.
And then the actual perpetrator confessed to four different witnesses, not cops, but like civilian witnesses. But the cops and the courts dismissed all of that as just being teenage bragging.
Yeah.
So based on that, I believed in Frank's innocence, and Frank believed in mine because of the DNA.
Okay.
So we used to get together once every 6 weeks, and half the conversation would be trying to keep each other going morale wise and the other half the time would be like a brainstorm session, like, you know, what's the next move that we can make to try to get the hell out of here?
Yeah.
You know, so so we kept each other going for 13 and a half years.
That's
and
great.
I was exonerated before Frank. And Frank was exonerated by DNA testing also a couple of years after me.
Oh, that's amazing that you both got out.
Yes.
I'm glad he's out.
So Frank was the main part. There were a few other people that I confided in here and there, but not very many because in general, you want to keep your head down. You know, telling people that I was innocent would result in them asking me a few questions.
And yeah.
Certainly one of them would be, well, what are the charges? And I didn't need to have, it was bad enough at times when people would discover what I was incarcerated for and the problems that that would bring.
Yeah.
But, you know, I couldn't like proliferate that by telling people, you know, what I really, you're in it. What are you innocent of? What's the charges?
And, yeah, exactly.
So, you know, so that's,
do you speak to Frank now or?
I did. Frank and I were in touch for about 7 years after he came home, but then he passed away.
Oh,
that's
gosh.
Sad.
Yeah.
That is sad, yeah.
Yeah, this whole...
I did get word from his lawyers that, you know, he was being exonerated, and so I drove up to 5 hours and to be present in the courtroom.
Oh, you know,
that's great.
And I spent the first 4 days... his first 4 days of freedom with him.
Oh, that's lovely.
So, that's so nice. This whole, your whole journey's been one serious game of chess, hasn't it?
It really has been.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Thank God I've made the right moves.
Yeah.
So what do you do now then?
Mm-hmm. So So I'm an advocate. You know, I started, I was an individual advocate for about 5 years.
Okay.
Was doing presentations across the country, and I caught on as a weekly columnist as well. I was trading privacy for awareness by doing media interviews in order to further the policy issues, and I was regularly meeting with elected officials.
Right.
I got a scholarship from Mercy College to finish the bachelor's, and then I got a master's degree, but my thesis was written on wrongful conviction, causes, and reform.
Mm-hmm.
Then after 5 years, and it was a really hard 5 years. I mean, to just take a half a second on that, you know, it was psychological after effects.
Yeah.
You know, and then the stigma of having been in prison, yeah, wrongfully, but having been there for 16 years. So how much of that rubbed off on you? Was it safe to be alone someplace with you?
Yeah.
So there's that technology, you know, the world was different. Technology was different. So GPS, cell phones, internet hadn't been invented. Culture was different. City and towns looked different. So I felt like a fish out of water. They release you without anything. You know, New York State does have financial compensation, but you have to, that's a process. You have to get a lawyer and file a lawsuit. And, you know, so I was always passed over for gainful employment, you know, and I had some particular challenges because recalling that I was in prison from age 17 to 32. So I had never before lived on my own. I never went shopping. I never had a driver's license. I never had to balance a budget or write a check. So
yeah,
it was really hard for me. But after about 5 years, I did get some financial compensation, and I wanted to take my advocacy work to the next level. So I started the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation for Justice. And as I mentioned, we've been able to free 10 people. We helped pass 3 laws. So videotaping interrogations, identification reform, DNA database expansion.
Amazing.
I'm an advisory board member of the coalition, the national coalition group called It Could Happen to You, which the foundation is part of. And
okay.
We do our policy work through them now together. And we were able to pass a couple of laws pertaining to oversight of prosecutors. We passed a different law which pertained to sharing evidence between the prosecution and defense early on in the process. And, you know, we passed another law in Pennsylvania pertaining to automatic expungement. So there were people in Pennsylvania that were exonerated, but still in court, but they still had records, which would hurt them when they went for job interviews.
Okay. So, okay.
Yeah. So we have 10 cases that are active now. I'm an attorney, as I mentioned, and, you know, I've entered a few of those cases myself as co-counsel. We're pushing policy changes in New York. So we're trying to repass the oversight for the prosecutors, and we're also when they passed the law mandating videotaping interrogations, they made exceptions. They made exception for sex offenses, drug cases, and certain types of murder cases. So we're trying to get rid of those exceptions. There's another bill which would prevent the police from using deception when interrogating, because that's coercive.
Yeah.
And we are pushing parole reform as well. I mean, a lot of people are denied parole that are worthy applicants just by the parole board just referencing what the crime was instead of evaluating whether they've been rehabilitated or not.
Right.
So there's that and what's called elder parole. So, you know, we're saying that if someone's 55 and they've served 15 years, they should be entitled to a parole board review. You know, because the prison is not equipped to deal with their advanced medical needs, and a lot of people age out of crime. So it really is a safe population that could be released. So that's what we're doing in New York. In Pennsylvania, which is a nearby state, Pennsylvania is one of 15 states that does not have compensation.
Okay.
So we're trying to push that, and the oversight for the prosecutors. In California, we're trying to get the oversight for the prosecutors. And we see a chance to get rid of the death penalty there, and which we're motivated to do, amongst many other reasons, the obvious risk of executing somebody innocent.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So those are the policy work. You know, but we're also trying to fundraise as well. You know, I gave us a running start. I donated 7 figures to the organization, but after about 3.5 years, I couldn't keep writing large checks. So I had to get rid of the employees and then get converted things to a volunteer organization. So in terms of right now, we have 2 part-time people, but we have about 6 or 7 lawyers that When we approve cases, we pitch the cases to them and they carry out the legal and investigative strategies that we've outlined.
Oh, okay.
So in that way, we have 10 cases going now besides the people that we helped to get out.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, then we have about 20 volunteers as well. But ultimately, you know, I would like to again have in-house employees. I know what went well before. I know it could be done better. So in terms of that, we're always looking for board members. We're looking for celebrity spokespeople, people who have a bigger following on social media. We apply for grants as well.
Yeah.
And my crazy idea, we have a crowdfunding site on the website, Patreon, which is for people who are willing to be recurring monthly donors. So my idea was, what if there were 25,000 people willing to, you know, willing to part with $3 or $5 on a recurring monthly basis? You know, that would give us a large budget, which we could then use to have in-house attorneys, investigators, paralegals, and other.
Yeah,
absolutely.
That would increase our capacity, and we would also be able to do policy work in 3 additional states, you know, and just try to do something with the federal government as well, rather than just in the 3 states. So, you know, trying to do that. There is a program called Amazon Smile Program, which when people register for a charitable organization, Amazon donates a small percentage of the sale to the nonprofit without it increasing the cost to the assumer. So, you know, the Jeffrey Dessner Foundation for Justice does is one of the organizations people could register on Amazon. So we're, you know, pushing that out there as well and chasing donors and trying to free people and change laws. So
that's good. If you give it at the end of the show, if you give us the link to your Patreon, we will give that to all of our listeners as well.
Yeah,
so they can check that out and possibly subscribe.
That would be wonderful. Sure. I mean, the end game vision, you know, is that I would ultimately love to have a chapter in office in each state and ultimately in each country, because I see wrongful conviction as a worldwide issue.
Yeah, definitely.
And the places where we're not hearing about wrongful convictions is not because they're not happening there, it's because people aren't, there's nobody working on the cases.
Yeah.
You know, there's nobody doing any of the exonerative work. I mean, some countries, their legal system is so bad that they don't, policy work needs to be done just for there to be even a way of bringing new evidence back to the courtroom. There's no procedure to even bring evidence back to court.
Yeah, I completely get you, and it is a worldwide issue. But
I think that's an amazing goal to have, to be honest. Mm. Yeah,
absolutely, and we support you 100%
every step of the way.
But the sort of last question I wanted to ask you just before we leave you and everything is, you know, are you content now? Are you happy?
Yes, I'm content now. I'm happy. Mostly.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm still trying to put the social part of my life fully together. I mean, that's not fully in place. I think when that's in place, and I think that, you know, when we have more of the funding in place that I want to have, I mean, then I'd be able to maybe enjoy things a little bit more. But so overall, though, I am overall, I mean, with those things aside, which would get me to an even better place, overall, globally, I am happy.
That's good.
I try to enjoy the world. I try to do that by trying new things, going to new places, sampling new food, activities I haven't done before. I do enjoy traveling and, you know, playing chess as well. So
I don't blame you. I mean, you want to see the world now.
Yeah.
Yes.
Have you seen the UK? Have you been down here?
No, I really, really want to. I mean, I'd love to do somewhat of an, I'd love to do like a working vacation over there.
Oh, do it. Yeah.
Come and do a bunch of presentations, do some media, meet with some elected officials, have plenty of free time mixed in with that. And maybe go for a month, right?
Yeah. Fingers crossed, when stuff goes back to normal, you can do that.
Mm. Yeah, I would love to be able to. I would love to be able to do that for sure.
Yeah, and we're going to try and spread your story throughout the UK as much as we can.
Yeah, absolutely.
For you.
That would absolutely be wonderful. You know, there is a movie I'd recommend people to watch. Actually, two things. So firstly, there's a documentary short out about me called Conviction, which is on Amazon Prime.
Okay, oh, cool.
20 minutes long, and it's about my advocacy work and life post-exoneration. So it's different than the other documentaries out there that are more like legalese or more into the facts of the case. This is more what I just mentioned. Mm. So I would recommend people, you know, watch that. But the other thing so far, and I keep up to it because I feel like it's kind of my homework in trying to keep current in the field. So I do watch a lot of movies based on wrongful conviction.
Okay.
So as it turns out, by coincidence, because I'm being interviewed by YouTube today, I think that the best movie on wrongful conviction was actually around a case that took place in the UK.
Okay.
Oh, really?
Nice.
And so I want to recommend to the listeners and yourselves, watch it when you need something to do.
Yeah.
So if the movie is called, and it was a brilliant title, because it was kind of like a play on words. It's like a double entendre where there's a double meaning.
Love it.
Yeah, yeah.
So the name of the movie was called, In the Name of the Father.
Right.
And it was about, the Guildford Four. And so not to be a spoiler, but it's a wrongful conviction case that happened in the UK. Mm. And so there was a father and a son co-defendants along with other people, but they're like the main protagonists there.
Yeah.
And so when his lawyer finally goes to, I forgot if it's the court clerk or from the police department, one of the two. And he mentioned the clerk hands the lawyer the folder, but it's for the father's case. It's right. Not for her client. It's for the father's case.
Right.
Oh, my God.
And the key information that had been withheld, which became, that was in that folder, and that's what exonerated, Sherry Conlon and the rest of the co-defendants. So it was a really big case. So I would encourage everyone to check that out.
Nice.
Check that out. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. We definitely will.
Absolutely, well, yeah.
We are coming to the end of our show now. So we just want to thank you so much for coming on and telling us your story.
It's been amazing.
Yeah, thank you for having me on, and I'll email you the links. And
yeah,
it was great today. I was international today.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And yeah, thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
You've been great.
Mm.
Thank you. And absolutely. Hey, hopefully when I do come over there, just send me the city or town. I would love to meet you in person.
Oh, absolutely. Great. We'll grab a beer.
Yeah, it'd be our pleasure.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.